Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptag. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and a pen to take notes during the course. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From California, Governor Schwarzenegger signed a bill last week imposing a 90-day moratorium on foreclosures in California. The bill exempts lenders who have a modification program in place meeting standards set forth in the bill, including reduction of payments to 38% of the borrower's income, higher than the 31% DTI standard in the Obama administration plan. Nevertheless, a halt to at least some foreclosures is a key missing piece of the administration's plan announced last week. Outside of California, and apart from lenders with voluntary foreclosure freezes, homes will continue to be foreclosed while the new program, perhaps even the legislation to allow bankruptcy court restructuring, is rolled out. This means not only needless home losses, but also needless losses for banks to the tune of about $125,000 per house in January. While the administration's new plan has some merit, it doesn't actually stop any foreclosures, which is the point. Regrettably, the Obama-Geithner plan perpetuates two basic flaws with mortgage modifications to date. Payment reductions are temporary, 5 years, so that we will have another payment shock crisis in 2014, and homeowners, for the most part, are not deleveraged because principal write-downs are not an essential part of the program. To its credit, however, the administration is sticking to its guns on supporting bankruptcy stripped-down of underwater mortgages, but that will still require getting past opponents in Congress. There's something that people in Iowa in particular should understand, that if one's home is in foreclosure and one files a demand for the delay of sale, under most circumstances, you will be able to get a six-month delay before the sheriff's auction under that kind of demand. There are some little points that you have to be careful of depending on what the mortgage foreclosure is asking for before that happens, so you would need to get legal advice. But that does, in practical effect, delay the sale after the mortgage judgment for 6 to 8 months or even more under most circumstances. Next, I want to play for you the Congressional Oversight Panel report entitled Valuing Treasury's Acquisitions by the chairperson Elizabeth Warren.
My name is Elizabeth Warren, and I'm the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel. I'm here to introduce our third monthly oversight report, which has the snappy title, Valuing Treasury's Acquisitions. In our first oversight report, released 2 months ago, we asked Treasury a lot of questions. One was whether the public was getting a fair deal when it put taxpayer money into financial institutions and got shares of the business back out. Secretary Paulson said yes, the transactions are at or near par, which just means that when the taxpayers put in $100, the value of the shares they got back was also $100. That sounds fair. We could have stopped there, but we decided that we should check this out for ourselves. So we got together some big-time finance experts, and we commissioned our own very technical and very sophisticated review of the 10 largest purchases made by Treasury with TARP funds. There's a 700-page analysis and a supplemental legal analysis of the deals on our website. But here are the highlights. First, we learned that on the next day after the deals were announced, after everyone knew that the banks were going to get billions of dollars, the value of the stock and warrants that Treasury received was far less than Treasury paid. Second, we found that the difference between the price paid and value received was greatest for those institutions that were in the most trouble. And third, we learned that the deal Treasury received was not nearly as good as private deals that were not completely comparable, but that were made at about the same time. Now, Treasury may have good reasons for this price difference. We want to hear more, but we're not yet ready to wrestle with the question of whether these kinds of subsidies are a good idea. Not yet. Instead, we want to start with one really important point. We think that Treasury should have leveled with the American people about the purpose of the program. If we are going to subsidize the banks, and subsidize some of them a lot more than others, then let's not dance around about it. Explain what's happened, and let's have a good old-fashioned debate about whether this is the smartest way to spend our money. We think the hard numbers are important right now before we spend any more money. So here's how it works out. In the 10 largest transactions made with TARP funds, every time Treasury spent $100, it took back assets that were worth, on average, $66. Do that enough times, and it adds up to a $78 billion shortfall on the first $254 billion in deals. The numbers get even more interesting when you break them down by program. In the 8 deals made under the Capital Purchase Program, this is the program designed for so-called healthy banks, we found that Treasury received $78 for every $100 spent. In the 2 deals made under the programs designed to provide aid for financial institutions that pose a higher risk of failure, Treasury spent $100 to get back assets worth only $44. So that tells us about the market value of what we got. But some people think the markets are a little crazy right now. Okay, so we have another comparison. We lined up Treasury's investments against 3 large transactions made by private investors during the same time period for an idea of what a determined investor could get in the market at that time. These deals aren't directly comparable because the terms are different, but they tell us something about what a big purchaser of assets might ask for and get. The 3 deals we used as a comparison were the same ones we mentioned in our first report. Using the same very technical methods we used to analyze the Treasury deals, we found that the private investors bought assets worth at least what they paid for them. Here are the numbers. For each $100 Mitsubishi invested in Morgan Stanley last September, it got securities with a fair market value of $102. For each $100 Berkshire Hathaway invested in Goldman Sachs last September, Warren Buffett got securities worth a fair market value of $110. And for each $100 Abu Dhabi and Qatar invested in Barclays in October, they received securities with a fair market value of $123. I'll say it again, these numbers are not directly comparable, but it gives us an idea of the ability of a big investor to extract bigger price concessions. There's one more important point. The company-by-company numbers are along a range. While Treasury got $93 for every $100 it paid buying equity in Wells Fargo, it got only $50 for every $100 it invested in Citibank. The gap between value and investment in Treasury's deals suggests that these things that Secretary Paulson called investments were actually subsidies for struggling banks. With a new administration in place, Treasury may have some time to rebuild TARP's credibility with the public. Either way, our panel's job stays the same. We keep pushing for answers and more transparency from Treasury, and we keep coming back to you with what we find. You can read our latest report and follow our work at cop.senate.gov. cop.senate.gov. That's cop.senate.gov. We're talking about a lot of money here, and since it's your money, we think you have the right to know how it's being spent.
So that was Professor Elizabeth Warren, who is the head of the Congressional Oversight Panel on the TARP funds that are being distributed, in her commentary on the actual activity that has been going on and the financial results of that activity, which are imposed on taxpayers. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to go to the second segment of our weekly show, where we look at opportunities, ideas, and programs for you to help deal with the credit crisis in your life, personally and socially, and also to create a future for yourself in terms of your finances. As is always, I do start with an important credit. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Emilian Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also, I suggest that you look at the archives at www.kruufm.com under the Life and Debt section, so you can go over and review the prior Life and Debt shows so you can get a total vision of what we've been doing here. It actually would be a very, very good thing for you to do. Last week we were looking at the love and money components, the golden rules, and we're up to rule number 6. And what we're trying to accomplish here is to get some idea of how a relationship, that very intimate relationship that you have with your partner, your spouse, long-term, lifetime kind of relationship, is influenced by money and debt particularly, and how to deal with it. And rule number 6, which we were up to, is called fight fair. We were distinguishing the reality that sometimes you are fighting, but it's not really about the money, although that money is an issue that comes up and it's used as a weapon, but it's not really the point. Well, fight fair is the other side of it, when money really is the point. What happens when money is really what you're fighting about? And it is true that people have different tastes, different priorities, and you can, of course, even in a very great relationship, disagree about your mate's choice when it comes to money. And that's what normal couples have to deal with. So what we suggest is some ground rules for fighting fair about money. And the first one was, don't hit below the belt. And that's a very important thing, because your partner may feel deeply humiliated over some loss that they have about money in their life. And it is a rule of thumb, a golden rule, to never use this to your advantage in the fight. For example, they may have lost their job, they may have filed bankruptcy before, they may have been sensitive about something that was hurtful in their lives regarding money. They possibly messed up somehow in the past, whether with you or not with you, but it's really important not to dredge that up and stick it in their face during a debate about money. It just would be so inflammatory, it's not a wise thing to do. The second thing is, don't blame your partner for joint decisions. For example, if you were both involved in a contract signature on a mortgage, a vehicle, you may not have agreed with it 100% while it was being negotiated. However, once you do sign that, it's too late to attack your partner if that deal goes south, if somehow it didn't work. The moment you agree to go along with it, you really, in effect, forfeited your right to blame your partner if the things don't work out. If a joint deal goes south, then own up to your half of the decision, which turns out to be a bum decision. The next point is don't make generalizations when you're in these debates, calls fighting fair. Calling names or making sweeping statements like, you always do this, you always spend too much, or you never do that, you're never careful with money. Whatever dumb thing that you think your mate did, whether it is factually true or not, really isn't the point. Sweeping statements about how someone always overspends or is never careful, really, if you look at the statistical analysis, it's certainly not true. But you can actually make that situation into a Supreme Court battle because you're transforming something small generally into something huge. And these words can be very, very hurtful and change a minor kind of spat into a raging battle quicker than you can even imagine. And once those words go out, you can never take them back. So you have to be careful with your tongue when you get into these kinds of arguments. And then finally, in the situation where there is a little bit of a battle going on, you don't take every difference as a personal insult against you. Differences about money are not intended as attacks. And it could just be that a person who has some money ideas that you don't agree with, for example, they don't want to spend money on flowers, for example, because they're going to die, or you may rather go out to dinner rather than cooking because you don't feel you cook well, that kind of thing. Sometimes money decisions are just about money, not an expression of your innermost feeling towards the other person, and don't take it as a personal attack that the person wants to, your mate wants to do something different with money than you think is completely ideal for you. So that's golden rule number 6, fight fair. Moving over to golden rule number 7, divide and conquer, it's called. And that is a rule regarding financial equality, meaning that we share the decision making and sharing the responsibility. It does not, however, mean that you have to share the chores equally. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that when it comes to money, there are some people who are strong in one part of the spectrum and not strong in other parts of the spectrum. You and your partner have different temperaments and different talents. One of you can be very organized and the other one could be not so organized. One is possibly very good with numbers and the other possibly isn't. And it's also the consideration that one has some financial knowledge and acumen while the other gets nauseous just thinking about money. And usually after a few decades of being together in marriage, long-term relationships, permanent partnerships, you really sort that out. You tend to come up with the proper solutions. However, if we're in a new relationship and that relationship means divvying up the chores, then it can be a lot more complicated, especially if you aren't married and your financial lives are really still separate. So the tips for dividing and conquering are as follows. And of course, the point here is that because of the nature of the relationship, your money is still mostly separate. So one, you start by deciding how much you will each contribute to the joint expenses. If your income is a lot higher or lower than your partner's, what we do and we always suggest is using the balance money formula as a guideline, which essentially, if you can remember, you both contribute the same percentage of your income to the must-haves, which are the bare necessities, 50%, and you both contribute 30% of your income to the wants category and 20% to the savings category. That's where the money goes, but then how to divvy up the chores. Unmarried couples often decide, since they're splitting the expenses 50-50 or so, they split the chores 50-50. But financial chores are really no different than any other chores, and you have to go with the strong suit. if one partner is strong at something and the other one's not, for example, the checkbook, and the other person is not, you don't fight it. One does that chore and the other may do a completely different kind of non-monetary chore while that is being handled. So that's an important thing. Instead of trying to split all the financial chores 50-50, divide responsibilities in a way that makes sense. If one is more organized, then that person keeps the records. If one negotiates better, that one makes the deals. If you are the only one willing to do what it takes to get your money in balance, however, then frankly, you just do it. You're both 100% responsible, but you can't each do 100% of the tasks. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And this week I'd like to go into the eighth and final golden rule in love and money, and that is learn the art of compromise. You're doing your honest-to-goodness best to have a happy, healthy money relationship. That is what the goal of this show is all about. And yet, it can come up that you still disagree. And not on the little things, but on the bigger things, the very big things, the stuff you can't just cover with your fun money, your wants money, such as, for example, one of you wants a different, bigger, better house. The other wants a fancier, faster, new car. These are really big decisions in a relationship, and no amount of good intentions can make them go away. You can't avoid it. And you can't go off on your own and separately make that decision. So what do you need to do? Well, the first rule, and I get this from my wife, who is a therapist, you keep talking. You need to communicate. Talk isn't expensive, and yet it can come up with a lot of new opportunities to come to a conclusion. So whether we're talking about a car, a mortgage, childcare, retirement investments, start talking and keep on talking. And watch out for whatever you think, or I've got it all under control, or I told you so, or this mess is all your fault kinds of responses. We're not into those at all. We're trying to be very civil and completely on the up and up with each other. And we want to make sure that we are making the decisions in a healthy way financially and also in an emotionally healthy way. That's very important, that we're not only thinking about money, we're thinking about the relationship, because in my profession, I see relationships go under regularly because of money. Bankruptcy and bad relationships, divorces, all seem to go hand in hand these days. It's often a matter of people hadn't spoken. They got into the circumstances, they went off on their own, they made major decisions without really implicating the other person's thinking, feelings, etc. So to avoid that, there has to be conversation, and certainly there is a lot to talk about. And you keep the conversation going, and that can go for a long, long time before that decision is being made. But it will result in a healthy outcome. And in that time, in that process, you can go to those areas like consumer reports, discussing it with your friends about their similar purchases. And with that, you bring back more information to the table and open another avenue in that conversation. And once you get it open, keep it open until you both feel 100% responsible for the final decision. It's very, very important in that relationship. So that was point number one, keep talking. Point number two is put time on your side. Sometimes it's just a matter of timing. It's not anything more than that proposition. A nice vacation this year, remodel the kitchen next year, for example. Kids need more room now. and there will be a nicer car down the road. You can layer these things over time. You each want something a little bit differently, but you both want it both, not only for oneself, but for each other. And that's great. So instead of saying it is a vacation or new sofa, for example, you decide that you will save for both. You get something and your partner gets something. It takes longer, and you recognize that you both have legitimate wants, but you work together for them. And that realization is priceless, not only in the financial sense of getting what you want, but in terms of creating a deeper, stronger, more loving bond in that relationship. So that means put time on your side. And the third point here is you focus on the bigger picture. Now, we've done so many things in the love and money area, went through the 8 rules, golden rules of love and money, and yet perhaps you find that you are still squabbling. And when that happens, you have to step back and keep an eye on the bigger picture, the bigger perspective. Even if you can't agree on everything, there are some very big things you can agree on. For example, your bare necessities. Generally, you both want to keep a roof over your heads. That's a very important thing. You also want to have dignity. You want to be comfortable. You want to grow in that direction and have a retirement account so you are both feeling some sense of comfort and dignity later on. Even if you don't agree on how much money you put into that account or the size of your house or the cost of your house, those are things that you keep the bigger picture on and you're getting the basics. You both want to, for example, ensure your children's safety. You both want to stop fighting and you both want to stop worrying about money. When we start looking at those issues, this puts your disagreements into perspective. When a relationship has become bruised over the subject of money, reminding yourself of the common ground can be a healing opportunity. So we always come back to that. We step back, we look at the bigger picture, and we are able to put things into perspective and recognize really the important things in our relationship, and we will be able to progress together for a long period of time in deeper love and with more financial stability and progress. To wrap up the love and money area, I'd like to quote from Professor Warren. She calls it the heart of a relationship. Money can be the hardest kind of intimacy. Money is wrapped up in attitudes and values shaped from infancy. Sometimes it feels as if everything we stand for can be expressed in terms of how we spend our money. Negotiating the shoals of money intimacy can be as difficult as anything you will ever face together. The difference between you and your partner can be subtle and hard to interpret, and landmines are everywhere. Worse yet, money issues are pervasive. Even if you never talk about money, you will develop a money relationship, for better or for worse. Whether you discuss it every day or shroud it in silence, you and your mate will decide who works, who spends, who pays which bills, how much debt you carry, and how much you save, all of which forms your money relationship. Every money relationship can be made better. No matter where you're starting from, it really is possible to improve the role that money plays in your relationship. So give it a try. Even if you're not convinced that all these ideas will work in your relationship, give it an honest effort. Get on the path to balancing your money and get on the path to the joyful, fulfilling, rewarding relationship that you and your partner deserve. So that's a quote from Professor Elizabeth Warren. And join us next week as we continue this quest to understand money, debt, and life. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.